Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I am proud to bring you Hercules and the Planetary Powers, crossing over with Hercules and the Space Gods. Launching this new series are the scholars from the Edge of Time, Nicholas Dyack and Michelle Brittany. And tonight we're going to explore ice pirates. Greetings and welcome, O scholars. Hello?
Sorry, we were muted on our end. We're also kind of giggling just because ice pirates. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
We're doing okay. Long day at work. It's nice to unwind. Nice to talk with you and talk about a fun film.
Same here.
Underscore on the fun film part.
Well, I will hand the baton of the show over to you, and I look forward to listening to what you have.
All right. So this is our first time, you know, kind of switching over from the peplum stuff and the mummies and Egypt stuff and the comic stuff to talk about ice pirates, which is kind of sort of planety. That's why we're all here. So
yeah.
I guess we'll start, you know, I'll give a quick plot synopsis, and Michelle and I will, you know, we each got our kind of bullet points, you know, observations from the film, personal interactions with it, and so on and so forth. So, all right, so let's do that plot real quick. The galaxy is out of water. What water there is controlled by the Templars on their planet Mithra. Jason and Roscoe are the leaders of a pirate crew and a crew of robots, and they ambush Templar ships, steal their ice, and make money. On their latest escapade, Jason happens upon a hibernating Princess Carina that he falls in love with. The Templars counterattack Jason and his pirates, but he and Roscoe are captured and sent to Mithra to be castrated and sold to slavery.
Wow.
But Princess Carina rescues them, though, because she needs them to find her lost father. They fly off to a pirate planet, and out in the desert, they meet up with another pirate who provides some clues on Karina's father's whereabouts. They are suddenly attacked by bounty hunters, which, of course, they repel. I kind of left that part out of my plot synopsis.
That might help.
So, next, Jason and his crew fly off to a planet full of Amazon women riding unicorns, where they meet Bruce Valanche. They get Karina's father's ring, which turns out to be a hologram, much like R2-D2 with his Princess Leia recording. And this recording informs them how to get to the mythical seventh planet, which is a fabled planet full of water that is beyond a time warp. So the pirates set off for this planet with the Templars in tow. They enter the time warp, and a huge melee breaks out between the pirates, the Templars, and all the robots. And everyone begins aging rapidly because, well, they're in a time warp. The tide is not going toward it, Jason and his pirates' favor. But the day is saved, though, when Jason and Karina's adult son, because they're in a time warp, swings in and farts the bad guys. Time reverts back to normal, and the pirates find the mythical planet, which turns out to be Earth.
Wow.
That's Ice Pirates. So a little bit of background. I'd never seen this movie before. Michelle, had you seen it before?
No, I hadn't.
Somehow or another, this has eluded our radars. Now, we've seen, like, the movie for sale before, like, back in the 2000s, you know, Michelle and I, we used to always go to a lot of, like, used bookstores and used record stores. And I swear that old school MGM DVD of Ice Pirates was everywhere. And to be fair, its cover art looks like a Star Wars kind of influence poster.
And I would say sort of a Mad Max, too.
Oh, yeah.
With all the vehicles down at the
bottom. There's definitely Mad Max influence in this.
Yeah,
we'll talk about that. But we'd never plucked it up, but I think it was a month or so ago, there's a YouTube channel that Michelle and I watch called Red Letter Media, And they did a retrospective of Ice Pirates, and we watched it, and like, hey, we know of that film, and this actually looks like a lot of fun. We should probably put it on the to-watch list.
Now, a caveat to that is that Rich on that show had seen this movie when he was a kid, and I guess watched it a fair amount, as well as some other movie. So he hadn't seen it since he was a kid, and he didn't feel that it had held up too well, but... It definitely sparked our interest.
It sparked our interest. And then, of course, the Hercules put out the call for adventure for, well, Sword and Planet Fair. And Ice Pirates is, so let's now get into the actual dialogue here. Let's talk about Sword and Planet stuff. And, you know, I think most people, when they think of Sword and Planet, you know, they think of John Carter, you know, the very traditional Earthman is put on another world. They get some sort of superhuman quality because of magic or atmospheric capability, but it's otherwise kind of a peplumy environment on another planet. And but you know, as you know, our usage of the word peplum is pretty loose here.
Yeah.
And it's pretty loose in a normal sense because some folks consider like old Italian swashbuckling and pirate films part of the peplum canon because it's all part of that kind of, you know, costume, you know, low budget movies that they did back then. So Ice Pirates, is this a Sword and Planet film? Let's ask that question first. So Michelle, do you think Ice Pirates is kind of a Sword and Planet-y film?
Yeah, it is kind of, and I think what helps it is the swashbuckling element of the film, which really lend itself to kind of that, I don't want to say a simplicity of that genre and kind of, I don't know, a base kind of tropes, but it does fit within that realm. I also feel that the battle scenes in Ice Pirates really lend to kind of the sword fight.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a little bit of comedic, there's a little bit of zaniness to it.
That Errol Flynn kind of big grin Robin Hood.
Definitely.
Yeah, even though this is a space film and very embedded in the Star Wars, there isn't a lot of, like, laser weapons or shooting in this. There's a little bit, but first and foremost, it really is swordplay and swashbuckling. And, excuse me,
And I can give a little bit of why that probably is the case. I did some research about Ice Pirates, looking at some interviews and getting a better sense of the film. So it might be helpful to know that this movie came out from MGM, and originally it was going through pre-production as a movie called The Water Planet. And it was supposed to be a serious film, and it was going to have a budget of more like 17 or 18 million. But there was changes coming up within MGM, and they decided, well, we can't afford that, so we're going to slash the budget down to 8 million. And they were talking to directors and who could come in and direct a lower budget film. And so that's how Stuart Raphael kind of came onto the scene, is because he had done independent films in the past. And so he pitched, instead of a serious film, he said, in order to make the story work within that budget, it needed to be rewritten into a comedy. And the studio liked it because, of course, you know, comedy sells. You still got that space environment and kind of coming off of the whole Star Wars films and things like that. But because it needed to be more of a low budget and kind of a tighter, you know, tighter to the purse strings, I think that probably is part of the reason why you had swords rather than a whole bunch of lasers that would have required a lot of effects.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we know, you know, swords are very disposable and utility-oriented things in old-school peplum films. I mean, I'm pretty sure vast majority of Italian peplum films, they probably used the same swords between films because of shared props and whatnot. So I could see that going on here.
Yeah, well, and these were more like the, I would say, the rapiers. I think that's what you call the more fencing-type swords. The other thing to bring up about Errol Flynn is that Raphael and the producer John Foreman, in an interview from the magazine Starlog, I'm curious how many people remember that magazine.
I remember that.
Yeah, I can remember I used to collect those back in the day.
You know, Hercules was buying Starlog for the Conan the Barbarian articles.
Well, I'm sure. Well, they had an interview back in May of 1984, and so they had quotes from John Foreman, like I said, the producer, as well as the director. And they said this film was actually inspired by a 1952 film called The Crimson Pirate, which starred Burt Lancaster. But they also got additional inspiration that came from Captain Blood and just about every Errol Flynn film where he crossed swords. And the reason that they chose pirate characters was because they were they're bold and they're connected to certain familiar mannerisms and attitudes. So,
and the pirates in here, they are traditional pirates, and like, you know, coats and eye patch type puffy jacket type stuff, because, you know, there are space pirates. I mean, space pirates is a common trope in a lot of, you know, space films and video games. And in fact, one of the actors in this, Ron Perlman, he was in Alien Resurrection, where, surprise, he's part of a pirate crew. But, and he's a part of a pirate crew and Ice Pirates, but, you know, the two types of crews are night and day. You know, the pirate crew in Alien Resurrection, they're gun heavy. You know, they have guns everywhere, guns hidden in thermoses and in their coats and stuff. You know, they are...
I think we could say they were pretty badass.
They were pretty badass. Well, the Ice Pirates and Ice Pirates, they are the romantic notion, the very Zorro-ish, Errol Flynn type of pirates. And to be fair, you know, because there's a little bit of a fantasy element to Ice Pirates. It doesn't embrace, like, magic as, like, some other, like, Star Wars-type planetary films would. But, you know, it'd be a couple more decades before you would get, like, kind of a swashbuckling film, and that would be the Johnny Depp Pirates of the Caribbean films, which, you know, some folks think is kind of, you know, neo-peplum adjacent because pirates, you know, black sails and all that stuff. So that's kind of one aspect of it. The other thing is, again, they're fighting Templars, which, you know, they look like characters from a Monty Python skit. They've got chainmail on, but also futuristic armor, so they kind of mesh that, you know, old religious, you know, well, Templar iconography while still being kind of spacefaring as well. And they have, like, you know, a religious order to them and all that
and
fun
and
stuff.
And also kind of, you know, that again, related to pirates, you usually have some sort of royalty and kind of some sort of militaristic faction to the ruling class. Their costumes were also very ornate. Obviously, you know, there's more money that they have, so their costumes are, you know, have gold
accoutrements.
Well, not just accoutrements, but just like the detailing is kind of gold stitching and things like that. So, you know, they exude, you know, a very rich lifestyle.
Like the Templars did with all their hidden money and all that.
I have to ask a question. I asked Michelle this question privately, but this is a question that has to go public. I saw Ice Pirates in the theaters. I probably saw it with Ron Carson, who's my cousin, and we used to go to the movies a lot when we were kids. But in Ice Pirates, there's a particular point, I forget which scene it was, but they're in like a desert area where if you look all the way at the top of the screen, you could see cars driving on a highway. And so it kind of broke the whole suspension of this belief thing. And when it came out on VHS, that scene was still there. Did they fix that for the DVD or Blu-ray version?
I didn't notice it, but because you bring that up, because, again, this is a very low-budget film, you know, a lot of the scenes are shot in what's obviously, like, modern-day factories. You know, when they're going through the scene, you know, their own conveyor belts that look like, you know, it's a beer bottling plant. You know, there's all these pipes and everything everywhere that looks like a normal, like, run-of-the-mill factory. These don't look futuristic. In fact, it reminded me very much of a movie that would come out a couple years later called Space Mutiny with Reb Brown, who was in Your Hunter from the Future. That ruled. But no, in Space Mutiny, a good chunk of that film is, you know, either stolen footage from Battlestar Galactica or shot like in a factory. Even though they're on this big spaceship, you know, you can see the factory windows and pipes and ladders and all that fun stuff. And Ice Pirates is filmed the same way. And so, you know, the sets don't look that futuristic. They look like, oh, they just went to, you know, the oil refinery down the road and shot there. But there is one scene, though, when they land on the planet Mithra and they're getting out of these cages. There's like these giant open warehouse doors, and you can see past it where it's kind of nighttime or dusk. So it's kind of dark, but it's still, you can make out the shapes of, and it looks like trees and telephone poles and like a normal side of a, like an apartment house or something. That I noticed. I'm like, did they just like open up the studio set and just kind of like forgot to black out the rest of the neighborhood or something? So there is some, I would call them goofs, or, you know, this is so low budget that we can't do anything about it type deal.
Now, one thing that I noticed that I picked up on, and I was telling Nick about it while we were watching the movie, is that I immediately cued into Logan's Run because there was this with the dome, which kind of covers the city, a part of it, and I was sure that was from Logan's Run, and I did confirm that we had a Logan's Run homage in there from that film. As well as Star Wars, or at least the warp drive capability.
The hyperspace scenes, where the stars kind of go pew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, another kind of peplum-y / sorted planet element is when they go to this kind of foggy planet where it has a whole bunch of Amazons riding unicorns, and they are Amazon women riding unicorns. In fact, the unicorns actually, like, impale a character, and the little unicorn horn takes off and everything. And then they go meet Bruce Valanche, which he's not quite peplum-y, but no, it's all scenes that could either be, you know, Amazon and that kind of Red Sonja / Hundra vibe, or you could take it, like, because they're pretty scantily clad, they're very Deja Thoris-y as well.
I'm surprised I don't remember that. I think I would remember Amazons on unicorns, but that faded from memory. So now I have to seek out Ice Pirates and watch it again.
So kind of to put a little tack in there, just as a note, if you're going to, and listeners out there, if you're going to pluck up Ice Pirates, I suggest do it sooner rather than later, just because Ice Pirates is put out by the Warner Brothers Archive Collection, which is their print-on-demand kind of Blu-ray service. And the scuttlebutt is they're discontinuing that service, you know, within the next year or so. There's a big post from, Jerry Beck, the guy that does all the cartoons and stuff, where he kind of said, you know, he works on a lot of these DVDs doing commentaries and stuff for old Warner Brothers cartoons. And he said, you know, he's not contracted out anymore because they're phasing out that line, which makes sense. You know, everything's going streaming and digital anyway, so why would you want to keep a print-on-demand Blu-ray service? So I know, and I think I posted it on one of your Facebook groups, you know, like 2 months ago or so. I actually went to the archive, Warner Brothers archive collection, and looked up any peplum films I didn't have and scooped them up real quick. So that's why I got, like, you know, The Slave and all those other ones. So, yeah, so Ice Pirates, it might be going at it like in a year.
Oh, that's a shame.
So, yeah, you know, Michelle and I, we're physical people. You know, we like having our physical media because, you know, things get lost digitally. You know, rights go somewhere, things just kind of disappear in the ether, so... So that ending, Ice Pirates, it ends on planet Earth. What other sci-fi movie ends where it turns out it was Earth all along?
Well, I was thinking about Galactica.
Oh, really? I thought you were going to say Planet of the Apes.
Oh, no, I wasn't thinking Planet of the Apes because I was so focused on the space element that I thought of Battlestar Galactica, and I'm talking about the original series because I haven't seen the remake.
I haven't seen the original series either. So,
well,
the original
Battlestar. Were you even alive at that time?
Maybe. I might have been a bad idea.
You might have been.
So the original Battlestar Galactica was they wind up with planet Earth at the end?
Their whole goal is to get to planet Earth.
And since Hercules, I know you like your cult films here. Mario Bava's Planet of the Vampires ends the same way, I believe, where it turns out at the very end they're on Earth as well.
You know, I even thought of that. I thought of that film more relating to the dreamy, like, element of the Amazon women on the unicorns because of the fog and the mist. And it was very mystical and kind of makes me think of, you know, if you had... like 300 with the Oracle and, you know, just the mysticism around it. It's very much about that.
Yeah, to go back to the Amazon women on the misty moon full of unicorns, you know, I think that's kind of a thing you did in the late 70s and 80s is we have no set. What can we do? You know, borrow a fog machine from Tangerine Dream and light it. Because, you know, the first Alien film, you know, when they go into the Alien spaceship and all the eggs are there, you know, it's completely foggy. We were watching this. Michelle brought up that it reminded her of Neverending Story where the horse is getting sucked into the quicksand, which made every kid cry.
Yeah.
But that was like super fun. Almost any like barbarian film after their, you know, town's been ransacked, you know, of course you come back to your town and it's foggy.
Well, and even Excalibur.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, moving along. I know.
So,
okay. I have this.
So the Amazons were on our. The Amazons were on our moon.
No. I just said because there's that movie called Amazon Women from the Moon or something. I was just making up.
I just watched that a couple of days ago. But the misty moon, since they were on Earth, is the misty moon of the Amazons our moon, or was this another moon in the solar system?
No, I was just making a bad joke. This is some other planet. Yeah, they don't arrive on Earth until the last 10 seconds of the film. Before that, you know, they're in their spaceship cruising around going to pirate planets and other planets.
Okay.
Yeah, they don't. Earth is the last, like, frame of the entire film.
It wasn't supposed to be, though. And do you want me to talk about that real quick, like?
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, go for it.
So at the very end, we see that the characters are gazing down at Earth, and they're like, oh, yes, we can see all the water. And, you know, it's the typical view of Earth. Well, apparently in the Starlog interview, or actually, excuse me, not that one, the Bristol Bad Film Club website in 2018 had an interview with the director, and he said that his ending had the gang flying over the beaches of Malibu with everyone swimming in the water. But apparently the studio said, we're not doing that. And they cut it with them gazing at Earth.
Wait, did they actually film the Malibu scene?
Well, they must have because Rafael says that he did not know that scene had been cut until he watched the film. And he said he needed a stiff drink of vodka to calm himself down. But he noticed that they cut the very ending off.
So But that's kind of a fun thing to do because, you know, the 80s was the beginning of that kind of sort of the fish out of water trope, but, you know, where you have someone either from a different time or a different world or a different dimension come to present day Earth, you know, you had Terminator.
Yep.
In the early 90s, you had Beastmaster 2, Beyond the Portal of Time. I mean, even like Star Trek 4, 3, 2, where they go and save the whales? Four. Search for Spock. All right, not Search for Spock. Ride Home. Journey Home. Guys, please, don't write in and kill me for my lack of Star Trek knowledge here. But that was the thing you did in the 80s, though, is you took someone from a different time or space or period or whatever, and you put them in the present day. So I could totally see them chilling out on Malibu.
I don't know why they cut it, because it kind of fits with the rest of the tone of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been kind of an early and kind of a trend-setting aspect of film.
Now, when I was doing the plot earlier,
we're getting mail on this one. People are actually sending comments. What do you call it? Tina Chandler says, "Oh gods, I have a favorite part of this movie. Prepare the eunuchizer."
Yeah, that's the scene where they all strap them to a conveyor belt, and there's a chompy teeth that are going to castrate the dudes. And that's that scene. They thankfully do not get castrated, although they have to pretend that they are by talking in a high voice.
Oh, okay. And we had somebody else type in, wasn't this the one where they were passing around space herpes? And somebody responded, that's a good memory. It is indeed.
Yeah, they like kind of in a throwback to the first Alien film, they find an egg, and inside the egg is, well, a worm that they call a space herpes, and it runs amok on the ship. And I think that's kind of like a joke coming out of like the 70s, because, you know, late 70s is kind of a dark time. You're in the drug-addled disco taxi driver type era. And, you know, you're kind of in dark humor territory. I mean, you know, this is, you know, Airplane was released, you know, just a couple years earlier. And they were making, you know, abortion jokes in that film. So I kind of see Ice Pirates as kind of an extension of running with that type of humor.
Yeah, and they even mentioned that, I think, in the Starlock interview, is that, you know, it was, at that time, you were hearing a lot about herpes and, you know, ending up with, you know, like everybody had herpes or something like that back at that time. And so I can kind of remember something about, like, you know, adverts about it. But, you know, and the little worm thing looks like the initial alien that comes out of William Hurt's stomach.
Yep.
So, you know, and that little herpy character was you know, going throughout the ship, you know, and the way everybody was like, oh, why didn't you tell me your ship had herpes type of thing? And the way they played it was, you know, obviously in keeping with the idea of herpes.
Now, when I was reading the plot, I made a kind of an offhanded joke, but I meant that only half jest. Where I said Jason and his pirates / Jason and his Argonauts, because I do think that there is a subtle hint of, maybe coincidentally, or maybe I'm just reading too much into it, or it's just kind of that compatible because it's mythology, but there is a Jason and the Argonauts aspect to this. You know, he's got his pirate crew, and as the movie progresses, he keeps adding more people to his crew. He's got... Angelica Houston is part of his crew, and she's kind of a Red Sonja type character.
Well, you have Killjoy.
Killjoy being the Hercules type character.
He was like 6'8", and he was very tall, big football player.
Yeah, and football player in real life.
And what's interesting about his character is that, you know, he's not just a strong man. He gets by on his wits, too, and, like, he's able to somehow keep from getting, you know, being on the conveyor belt.
He does a lot of disguises and stuff right in front of your eyes.
Yeah, he would be kind of like a, you know, a spy, sort of.
But there is kind of, you know, they're not searching for the golden fleece, but, you know, there is kind of that Homeric Odyssey type here. You know, they're not trying to go home, but, you know, they're searching for a dad. They're searching for the water world. You know, instead of, you know, being on their ship in the Mediterranean, they're on their pirate ship out in space.
Mm-hmm.
Still, you know, they're fighting, you know, not necessarily a Cyclops, but a space herpy and, you know, bounty hunters and stuff. So, there is some kind of nods to kind of religious aspects, you know, like they don't see people because, you know, what if there are gods and stuff out there? So I would say that this is, I would say it's an adaptation of Jason and Argonauts, but I would say that there's enough kind of similar crossover that, you know, the mythology is enough that it permeates into this type of story. But much like, you know, Star Wars is indebted to, you know, a lot of mythology. In fact, you know, Star Wars is indebted to John Carter. Ice Pirates is indebted to Star Wars, despite the filmmaker saying it's not. But I think you would appreciate the Jason and the Argonauts aspect of the film.
That makes me want to get it even more. I'm questing for it on eBay and Amazon as we speak.
You'll definitely appreciate the Amazon women on unicorns.
That's the Jason and the Argonaut thing too. The Lemnian women didn't have unicorns, but they were Amazons. So I'm glad they put that in there as well.
Well, and I think the seventh world is, you know, might be a kind of subtle nod to the seventh voyage of Sinbad.
Could be.
Which is all part of that genre.
Now, some other observations. One, kind of, this is just a funny anecdote. This is kind of put out there. Has nothing really to do with Ice Pirates, but the main star, Robert Ulrich, he died, which is sad. But we met his wife. Michelle and I used to go to a lot of, you know, conventions and shows. And, of course, you know, a global pandemic happened. But we were at a convention once where they had a big reunion of the cast from Sound of Music. And his wife, Heather Menzies, because she plays one of the kids in Sound of Music, she was there doing autographs and stuff. And she was actually raising money for her charity that she had with her husband on, you know, cancer and all that stuff. But so we went and met her. And, of course, you know, we know nothing about Ice Pirates or anything like that. But this is a funny aside. You know, she was in the movie Piranha, so she signed my copy of Piranha. And she signed Michelle's laser disc of Sound of Music.
Which is, it has kind of a funny story to it. Heather Mendez was, she played Louisa, in case everybody's wondering, which child from The Sound of Music? Well, she was Louisa. But I had taken in a laser disc, and it looks like a record for people that are not familiar with laser discs. And every time I went to the next person in the line, because they had them all in a row of tables, they were so fascinated by this laser disc that I know some of them were like, can you hold it up so I can take a picture of that? It was so funny. But yeah, I have all the kids' autographs on my laser disc. But I did not know about all of her, you know, like why she was doing the
Ice Pirates.
Well, why she was doing the charity, I didn't realize, you know, because you lose track of different actors and, you know, unfortunately, you don't always remember when they pass on or why they did, so.
Yeah, I wasn't familiar with Ulrich, but I could say, you know, I think he's got charisma in this film. He's got that Harrison Ford kind of vibe to it and a little bit of cynicism. So kind of some other movie connections here. So the ending of the film is, they're going through a time warp. They're battling the Templars. And as they're battling them, everyone's aging. So, like, every time a second goes by, like, a day goes by. So they're all rapidly aging during this giant melee. All the people are fighting each other and robots. And the robots aren't aging because they're robots. But
you know what? The robots were breaking down.
They were breaking down.
Which I thought was an interesting concept.
There's some attention to detail here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're growing beards right before your eyes and everything. But you know what that scene kind of made me think of, and this is a deep cut here, is the ending of 2001 Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Because Kier Dwella, you know, gets into his pod and goes past, you know, the moons of Jupiter and enters in the, you know, the psychedelic scene. And, of course, he's aging. You know, he keeps blinking and he's aging. And all of a sudden he's in the bed and he's aged and there's a space baby. I mean, Ice Pirates, it's at that level, Kubrick level.
I think we're the only one that's ever equated Ice Pirates with Kubrick. Good job, dude.
But you can't deny kind of, you know, how innovative, not innovative, but at least unique the ending for Ice Pirates is. Not the it was Earth all along ending. That's kind of gimme. But the time warp sequence leading up to it, I would never have expected them to do something like that. And that's pretty new, pretty refreshing, pretty unique.
Yeah, I mean, I think for all the things that we say are kind of funny about Ice Pirates and why we don't take it necessarily serious, but it definitely does have elements that I think would go on to influence and inspire other films that maybe did it better,
mm-hmm.
probably did it better.
The movie also makes me think of the Space Quest series of games. You're talking about the space herpy and how it pops up on the ship every now and then. In Space Quest 5, there's a parody of Alien where your garbage scow, you know, picks up some garbage and a parody alien pops out and it keeps running around your ship and you got to capture it. But Space Quest 4 is a time-traveling Space Quest game and you're actually saved by your son in that game. You know, your son from the future comes back to the past to save your character from a lot of stuff. And that's very much like in Ice Pirates where before they enter the time warp, you know, the main character and his beau, Princess Karina, you know, they have some romantic time under some sort of crazy beach simulator.
With rain.
It's very, very Fabio book cover. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I totally thought it was they were definitely making nods to the whole romance covers with the bodice ripping and the man without, you know, with the shirt falling off his shoulders and, oh, my gosh. Anyway.
But you know, they conceive a kid, but since they're going through a time warp instead of, you know, 21 years in reality, you know, she goes from, you know, pregnant to baby to have an adult kid, like, in a span of, like, 3 minutes.
Wow.
But you know, to me, that's kind of made me think of Space Quest 4, where, you know, the dad comes in and – not dad, the son comes in and saves the day. And also, in a weird sort of way, it makes me think of the video game Red Dead Redemption, where your main character dies in that game, but then you take over playing as the son character, who basically looks like the dad character, which in Ice Pirates, the son is played by – Robert Ulrich, you know, because hey, the dad looks exactly like the son. But it's novel. It's inventive and it's neat.
One of the other films that I was thinking about while we were watching it was that Robert Shaw did a film, and I didn't realize that it actually came out before Ice Pirates, called Swashbuckler. But that was a Robert Shaw, James Earl Jones, Peter Boyle, Genevieve Bujold, Beau Bridges, and others. And that actually came out in 1976. So we did have a pirate movie in there.
Robert Polanski had a pirate film in the 80s, didn't he, with Walter Matthau?
I think he did, and I'm trying to remember what the name
was. I think it's simply called Pirates.
We'll take a look.
Well, thank you, Wikipedia. Yeah, Roman Polanski will let us know. There was also that cartoon in the early 90s called Pirates of Dark Water, which I think is also kind of indebted to this, where that's definitely pirates on a completely other planet. And that was a great cartoon, but it didn't have a proper ending.
So I will tell you that, yes, Roman Polanski did have the Pirates movie, but it was definitely influenced by Space Pirates because his came out in 86.
86?
Yeah.
Now, kind of the setting in this movie, you know, it's in outer space, but water is a precious resource, so much that all the water in the galaxy can only be found on one planet, which is kind of being a reality because water ice pirates, you know, is one of the most common elements out there. Does it mean it's life making water? But I mean, you know, Pluto's covered in, you know, methane ice, and lots of our moons in our solar system are the Oort cloud is basically, you know, chunks of ice here and there. So it is kind of funny that ice is really abundant out there, and water is technically very abundant as well. It's just that, you know, the right ingredients to have an Earth-like planet are rare. So to have to me, I have to kind of laugh and say, oh, in the entire galaxy, there's only one planet with water. But it also kind of kickstarts that, you know, dying Earth genre of literature, mm-hmm. where, you know, Earth or some other planet is in its last days, or the universe is going through heat death, where there is no water. There was that movie based on the comic that came out in the 90s called Tank Girl that had Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah,
you know,
I
there's
remember.
No. I think some of the Judge Dredd stuff is like that.
Yeah.
Mad Max is like that. There's an episode of Sliders like that.
Yeah, and there's an older film, and I think it was called The Day the Earth Caught Fire, which is kind of a, you know, last days of Earth as it moves closer to the sun. So, you know, there's like no water and things like that.
Which, you know, kind of in a political sense kind of keeps in what's going on right now. We kind of take, you know, us as Americans here, take the ability to have accessible, fresh, clean water for granted while, you know, one, companies like Nestle bottle it up, or two, you know, other people in other countries don't have that luxury. So, you know, it's, you know, you watch Ice Pirates and you kind of go, ah, ha, ha, you know, ice and water and precious resource. But on the other hand, there is that kind of, I would say, you know, just kind of forward thinking that sci-fi movies do give us. They mm-hmm. do give you pause to say, well, why not? Why, you know?
Definitely. And, you know, you and I were talking offline, but I had read an article, I think about a year ago, definitely, you know, in the early part of the pandemic when there was some article discussing that water was going to be traded on the stock exchange, you know, interest in water, which, you know, there was a lot of concerns about that with regards to water ownership. And then, you know, it really was kind of, you know, unnerving and kind of scary to think that, you know, well, we think, oh, I can, you know, have water anytime I turn on the tap, or I can buy the water or whatever. But then when you start thinking about, well, what about the people that actually own the water and, you know, control the interest in water, you know, so you could get something like a Templar situation.
Why not?
Yeah.
There was a Sword and Sandal movie with a barbarian movie with David Carradine. I don't remember what the movie was called, but his name was Kane. And that took place on a world where water was a precious commodity, and it was controlled by the very powerful and the very wealthy. I don't remember the title of it, but...
Well, as a side note, you said David Carradine. Well, there is a Carradine in this film who makes like a 30-second appearance as an old man. But it's not David, though.
It's John Carradine.
John Carradine.
Mm-hmm.
And another kind of trope that this movie, I think, kind of helped pioneer is the idea of a person with an army of robots. Because mm-hmm. before this, you know, robots weren't really in a lot of films. They were, but not like in mass. Like usually you'd have like a scientist who had one robot. You know, Lost in Space, they had a robot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Forbidden Planet, they had a robot. Day the Earth Stood Still, a robot. And so the idea of actually having multiple robots, you know, you definitely saw in like Star Wars of all the droids. And I think Pioneer, like one person who basically has a whole bunch of robots underneath them, either as an army or something, because that's something you see a lot of now. You think of video games like Borderlands, where Handsome Jack controls an endless army of robots. You think of the Mega Man series of video games of Dr. Wily and his army of robots, where it's kind of a, you know, especially with the advent of like CGI, where it's easier probably instead of casting flesh and blood people to say, well, make them have an army of robots. We'll just, you know, copy paste because all the robots look the same anyway. So yeah. I think Ice Pirates helped break that mold of, you know, the Jetsons only had a robot, you know, Rosie, you know, that you can have not just multiple robots, but multiple mm-hmm. robots kind of like unified under, you know, instead of an army of henchmen or whatever, an army of actual robots.
And I will refer back to the Starlog article from May 1984, in which Foreman and Raphael talk about the fact that they actually used new technology regarding the robots, and that they were particularly proud of them, actually. They said they liked the super funky steam engine high-tech look. They definitely shied away from the real sleek because they wanted to convey the idea that pirates had to make do with what they could find and piece together what they could, which is in keeping with, you know, pirates, you know, being kind of low tech and things like that. But you have somebody on the ship that, you know, tinkers around and, you know, tries to work with these robots. I also thought from a movie standpoint, it gave them an opportunity to explore, you know, another kind of humor. To me, I would think I'm going to call it robot humor, but, you know, it's kind of toilet humor, but with robots. And it's just, there's a lot of humor in them.
Well, how many movies have we seen out there where you have that one genius person that, you know, scavenges the junkyard for parts and cobbles together their own robot? Mm-hmm. You know, it's an almost diesel punk attribute. I would say, yeah, Ice Pirates maybe flirts with diesel punk in that regard. And that's like decades before diesel punk was even a thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
I would say the other thing that I think we should bring up real quick, because I know time's winding down, is Spaceballs. Because Spaceballs came out, I think, 2 years after Ice Pirates. And that's an overt parody of Star Wars and Star Trek. And I know one of the criticisms that Spaceballs got from critics was, why are you parodying Star Wars when it came out so many years earlier? You kind of, you know, parodies, you have to kind of hit that window of timing or else it become irrelevant. And Ice Pirates, to me, it's 87? Mm-hmm. Wow, even later than I thought. So Ice Pirates, you know, 3 years before Spaceballs. But here's the thing about Ice Pirates. It's not a parody, though. It has funny moments, but it's more of, you know, kind of like where you have, like, an adventure film that has a lot of kind of lighthearted banter in it. I, you know, if anything, I'd almost equate it to, you know, something like Romancing the Stone with Michael Douglas and
Kathleen Turner,
where it's an adventure film first, but, you know, you have, you know, witty dialogue and funny situations that add a kind of cartoony element to it. That's what Ice Pirates would be, is a sword and planet cartoon more than a flat-out parody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it succeeds in that regard.
Yeah, I feel like the references that Ice Pirates use are definitely older,
mm-hmm.
that I feel like, you know, Errol Flynn is not as recognizable name as it would have been, you know, 70 years ago or something. So I feel like in a way they were pulling from resources that were rather old and gave it a new, you know, kind of fresh paint, so to speak, with some of those older tropes.
You know, it's funny. Spaceballs is overtly a parody of Star Wars first and Star Trek second, but the movie that Mel Brooks did after Spaceballs was Robin Hood Men in Tights. And even though that film came out as a response to Robin Hood Prince of Thieves, mm-hmm. it's not really 100% parody of Robin Hood Prince of Thieves. Mel Brooks was pretty adamant. He was parodying Errol Flynn Robin Hood and the Disney animated one instead. Mm-hmm. It just happened to have a lot of Prince of Thieves in it, but it was really more indebted to the Errol Flynn one. Let's be honest here. Cary Elwes, he's a pretty good Robin Hood.
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to Space Pirates, you have a lot of that because you're using, you know, basically the same character fabric between both films.
So I think that kind of wraps up Ice Pirates. It's not a quite like a magical space fantasy, you know, sci-fi fantasy that some, you know, movies I think like, was it Krull the Conqueror? No, Krull.
Krull,
yeah.
Or Krull? There's two of them.
Krull.
But, you know, it definitely touches on some of those neo-sorted planet vibes. You know, this is definitely coming off of the 70s, you know. Yeah, Krull, that's it. You know, because the 70s saw that resurgence of kind of space fantasy stuff kind of spearheaded by Lynn Carter and, you know, doll books and stuff were cranking them all out. Well, you know, here's the 80s kind of winding down on that. You know, you're kind of wrapping up all the sword and sorcery stuff with, you know, Conan and Fire and Ice and stuff. And I like to think that Ice Pirates is probably the swan song that kind of, you know, in that era. I mean, it probably goes in the same camp as like the He-Man film, you know, movies like, cartoons like Black Star, was it Black Star or Lone Star? Whatever. There's a pirate cartoon. What's that?
Yeah, I think it was Black Star.
Yeah. And this is kind of, I would say, the last parting shot of an era.
Well, and you know, as we've seen, movies and genres go through a cycle. So mm-hmm. this was the end of the pirate cycle, you know, to be picked up again once we had Pirates of the Caribbean. I just wanted to make a quick segue to Krull, which came out in 1983 as a science fiction swashbuckler film. It happened to be written by Stanford Sherman, who co-wrote Ice Pirates.
There you go. There you go. I have a soundtrack to Krull, by the way.
To Krull or Krull?
Yeah. Krull. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, awesome.
All right. Well, so I guess, you know, ending remarks. We dug it. Ice Pirates on film. An interesting take on the sword and planet genre. There's definitely, you know, scant traces of, you know, space peplum in there from, I'd say, Jason and Argonauts, Templars, swashbuckling, sword usage. Not really a strong man per se, but the Killjoy character kind of steps in to fill that kind of role. I dig it.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, the humor is from the 80s and, so a fair amount of it is not necessarily PC today, but it's an entertaining, it's, you know, an adventure film, and it's got those sword and planet elements in it.
It's got Amazon women on unicorns.
Yeah. Yeah.
we're going to sell this movie to you, Hercules, just on that 5-minute scene.
That works for me. You sold me with the Jason the Argonauts part, but yeah, that clinched it for me. And now I'm really curious to see not only what you guys spotted of anachronistic elements, but if I could find that highway again with the cars driving. So it won't be a film, it'll be an adventure.
But we'll pop the Blu-ray in and fast forward because there's only really one desert scene. And it's in the middle. Of course, here's the thing. They need to get, like, a dune buggy to ride out to the desert. And I'm like, but you have a spaceship. Can't you just fly to where you need to go? I don't know.
Well,
but does the spaceship have wheels like a dune buggy?
And you know what? We didn't even mention it, but it had, like, a cantina scene.
Yeah, there's a total Star Wars cantina. Because if you're going to do a space film in the 80s, you have to have a Star Wars cantina scene.
Yes. And then a fight broke out.
Yeah, and Angelica Houston has swords that are super sharp that she beheads a dude. She's like, "Tishow! I am now going to go play Morticia Adams."
Well, he was slighting women, and she wasn't having it.
This is unbelievable, but I'm remembering bits and pieces as you guys have been speaking. How can people follow the scholars from the edge of time in all their adventures? You have two other podcasts now, right? You have the horror cast, and you have Lovecraft podcast. So how can people enter your world?
Well, Hercules, we only have two shows, this one and our HP Lovecast podcast. You know, that's it. If we're not appearing on your show, it's our own HP Lovecast podcast.
I thought you had another show, too. I thought I read something.
No.
Maybe you appeared on a horror cast or something.
Yes.
I was saying, oh, great. That's fantastic that they're branching out.
No. Oh, man. We are stretched thin. We can't fit another podcast. As much as, you know, Michelle wants to do mummies and I want to do peplum and she wants to talk about kitties. We oh, man, how many podcasts can... No, but we did recently appear on a podcast called Burial Plot, which was really... it was nice to be asked to be guests on a podcast.
And, you know, for people that are interested, it's kind of a behind the scenes of our HP Lovecast podcast, which is dedicated to derivative works of HP Lovecraft. But we give, you know, some behind the scenes of, you know, how
our academic conference too.
Our academic conference, but how we work our podcast. That particular podcast, because Nick and I co-host that one. But as far as like where to find us, for me, I do have a website that's not up to date, but you can still take a look. I'm still working on it. It's michellebrittany.com. I do write about mummies and have. So I have a back library of Michelle's musings on mummies. And then if you look at my author page at Amazon, you can see stuff there. So I have a public page at Facebook, but you can typically find me posting over on HP Lovecast, which has a group Facebook page.
And I'm pretty easy to find. I'm at nickdiak.com, NICKDIAK.com. I do a weekly roundup of personal and peplum news, and I also write, you know, occasional articles and stuff there. There's also a giant podcast index there of all the podcasts either Michelle and I have done or appeared on, such as all the Scholars from the Edge of Time episodes. From my website, you can, you know, all the links are there to find me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Gmail and all that fun stuff.
All right, and they're well worth exploring. They're both very creative, they're both very prolific, and they're both lots of fun. So there's a lot there to explore, and I encourage folks to do it.
And of course, Hercules, we new crossover. We're very happy and very honored to be part of it. We're looking forward to being back next month on the fourth Thursday. I believe we're going to be talking about John Carter.
Yes.
John Carter, yes. I'm looking forward to that. And I greatly enjoyed today. You brought back a lot of fond memories of watching this movie in the theater and on VHS. And now I want to re-experience it on Blu-ray or DVD. So thank you very much. You guys are awesome. And thanks to everybody who tuned in to this new adventure. Until next time, this is all of us wishing all of you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And let me see, I can play Golden Bough for the half minute that we have remaining.
Stars in her eyes. trees whispered soft words of the wild. Time stood still, and the bees heard her sigh, and they danced to the music of her cries. Lady of moonlight, lady of day,